Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, thanks for tuning in and welcome to this week's Zonal Marking Podcast, which is brought to you by The Athletic. I'm Ali Maxwell, joined as ever by Warville and Cox. Michael, it's great to have you on the pod. As always, how are things? What have you been writing about? Catch me up with how you're doing before we get into today's topic.
Yeah, very well, thank you. Piece I've just got up on the website today is about Marcelo Bielsa. And I guess questioning the idea that he's a hugely influential coach. He's obviously a fascinating coach and has brought a great excitement to the Premier League this year. But I'm never completely convinced by the argument that he's hugely influential in terms of his impact on the modern game. So, yeah, check that out.
Tom, you've been working hard as ever. I hope you're in good form. And tell me what you've been doing for the Athletic site this week.
Yeah, one piece that Coxie and I have been working on together is a bit of a similar piece we did on Lionel Messi, but for Cristiano Ronaldo, essentially the evolution of Ronaldo, how he's changed over time, which I'm really excited to for it to come out. And then also doing a backgrounder on Dominik Szoboszlai, who is the Salzburg wonder kid, who's linked up to everyone. So it's a bit of a data dive in terms of who he is, what he does, and if he's actually any good.
Surely you're intrinsically opposed to a wonder kid whose MO is scoring ridiculous goals from 35 yards and taking a lot of low expected goal shots.
I don't know. I've got a lot of respect for any fellow other wunderkind, so it doesn't really matter what he does.
I'm just playing. We've got a really interesting topic, I think, to dive into today. And Coxie, I was hoping you could give us a brief intro into it before we get stuck in.
Yeah, we're going to be chatting about Premier League players who we think play unusual roles or play a role that is quite specific to their team. A few of them in the Premier League who are maybe not quite interesting enough for a podcast of their own, but I think combine five or six together and we should have a good chat today.
Yeah, and it's part of the sort of themes that we would like to touch on this pod. And I think there are probably, before we dive into the individuals, that there is a wider discussion to be had about positions and about roles and about our definitions to a certain extent as well. While we were researching this, while we were planning this pod, Michael, one of the things that kept cropping up to me was, are players still, even in the modern game, being defined too narrowly in terms of this is a player and he plays in X position, or if you like, in X role within a certain position? Are we still doing that too narrowly? Are we too narrow-minded with the way that we pigeonhole players?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's a lot of modern coaches who would get quite annoyed if you say a player is a right-back. You can say they play right-back, but no, a player is a collection of attributes and qualities, and in different systems they may play in different positions. So I think, yes, there's probably too much categorisation. And I think, you know, the fact that football has become more universal in recent years, there is, I think, more similarity between a defender and a midfielder these days than there were 20, 25 years ago, means it's increasingly viable for players to switch positions. And I think one good sign of a good manager is they're often able to kind of transform a player from what he was previously into a new role. So, yeah, I think you're probably right on that.
And Tom, would you say that the modern managers seem more likely to mix it up in terms of a player role and try a player out in a new position? It feels like, well, we've got plenty of examples to come over the course of the next half hour, and it feels like seeing someone being played nominally out of position is less weird than it used to be.
Yeah, for sure. It just feels less surprising, really. I think that a couple of examples we were talking about pre-pod were, I guess, Fabinho playing centre-back for Liverpool now. That really doesn't cause any ripples in the football sphere, so to speak, when he starts playing there. We're just kind of used to defensive midfielders slotting in at centre-back. We're used to full-back slotting into midfield, and I think that example, I guess, is Stuart Dallas Leeds, which we'll get onto. So I just think that maybe it's just a recent development that positional versatility is more of a part of the game, and therefore it's just a lot less surprising when we see it happening.
And I think there's something to be said for this happening increasingly in the women's game as well, maybe even more than in the men's game. I mean, I often look at the Chelsea side, I'm not quite sure who's playing as the fullback, and it turns out it could be three or four players, and they all do it quite well. Leo Williamson at Arsenal came through as a creative midfielder and is now playing as a pretty solid centre-back, because centre-back play in the WSL is so much more about passing than it is about aerial dominance, as we probably still think of it in men's football. So yeah, maybe that's something we can explore at a later date with Katie Wyatt, who's our new women's football correspondent.
Yeah, definitely. Let's focus on some individual cases then, some positional quirkiness. And the example that's probably freshest in the mind is Monday night, Wolves against Southampton. Wolves doing a lot of quirky things here, Michael, not only setting up in a back four, but also very unusual way of choosing which centre-back plays on which side.
Yeah, about 6 hours before that game kicked off, I'd written something about Wolves and said, Nuno always plays a back three. That's the one thing you can be sure of. And then sure enough, he went and played a back four for the first time since Wolves got promoted to the Premier League, because Connor Cody was out for the first time since Wolves got promoted to the Premier League. So that was interesting itself. And then it became even more interesting because it emerged that the left-footer, Kilman, was playing to the right of the centre-back partnership, and the right-footer, Wooly Bolly, was playing to the left, which I don't think I've ever seen before. So yeah, I found that very intriguing.
I mean, we've done a whole podcast on left-footed centre-backs, Tom. You even talked about angles of passing, and I mean, after that I never wanted to see a right-footed centre-back in the left centre-back slot ever again. So what did you make of Nuno ripping up the rule book?
Yeah, he's read my article and thrown it in the bin, quite frankly. It was definitely something new and different, and I mean, yeah, like Coxie was saying, I don't think we've seen really done before in the Premier League. I kind of wonder whether it was just to try and focus their passes more infield, but just looking at the combinations, it didn't look like that was the case at all. I think that Kilman's most common pass receiver was Wooly Bolly, and then after that, I think it was Semedo. So even though there was a three-man midfield of Dendonka, Neves and Moutinho, it didn't seem like the focus was to actually funnel the ball inside to them.
Michael, I doubt you've got much confidence now when it comes to second-guessing Nuno, but have you got any theories on this?
No, there's some decent ones in the responses to me on Twitter, which I'm going to put forward here. I mean, some suggested it was to do with Southampton's press and the fact that they often show the opponents kind of inside, they box them into a kind of a central press, and that would make it easier for players to kind of turn inside and switch play easily. A couple of Wolves fans actually pointed out they have done it in a back three. I mean, they have played Roman Saiz to the right and Wooly Bolly to the left with Connor Cody in the middle. I hadn't really thought about that before. I assumed that was just because Saiz had come in for Bennett and Bennett was right-footed. Saiz was the newcomer. So I thought they were just kind of trying to keep it the same. But apparently Nuno had tried it beforehand in pre-season matches. So maybe there is something, you know, a wider theory. But to be honest, I don't have a conclusive explanation. I don't think Nuno was asked about it after the game. But I think the main thing to note here is that whatever the reason, they switched to their proper sides at half time, so it clearly didn't work very well.
I really enjoyed jumping into that Twitter thread and seeing everyone was just shouting inverted centre-backs at you with varying numbers of exclamation marks afterwards. So I think the previous pod I was on, we spoke about you invented the inverted winger. Potentially this is the next one on that production line.
And we talked about Southampton the other day, didn't we, on our Overachievers podcast. We talked about that press, which may have been in the forefront of Nuno's mind when making this slightly strange decision and then switching it back at half time. At Wolves were certainly struggling with the movement up top, weren't they, of Walcott, and also, Tom, of a man who's surely an early season contender for the most improved player award that I've just created, Che Adams, stepping up big time for Saints this season.
He's a bit like a budget Harry Kane in the respect that he both creates and scores. I was looking at kind of his expected goals and expected assist data, and I think that if you look at guys who've combined for at least 0.25 XG and XA per 90, which, you know, puts him in the top 10% of or top 10 attackers in the league. He's actually level with Grealish and Salah for the volume and quality of chances he creates. So, yeah, Che Adams, one that I don't think I've read or seen much about, but he's definitely having a fantastic season as that, you know, 9.5 as we have to call it now.
To be clear, Tom, budget Harry Kane very much meant as a compliment in this case.
100%, yeah. The same way that I might be deemed a budget Michael Cox.
Okay. Well, Michael, let's go back to Wolves quickly before we move on, because it wasn't just the centre-backs that you found interesting, but also the role of Pedro Neto.
Yeah, so in that thing I was writing before Nuno ripped up the rulebook, I was basically writing about the fact that Wolves, I mean, since they got promoted to the Premier League, what, 2 and a bit years ago, Nuno's always played either 3-5-2 or 3-4-3, and you could always kind of tell which system he was going to use by his team sheet, because, you know, if Dendonka was in as a third central midfielder, it was a 3-5-2. If there were three outright forwards, it would clearly be a 3-4-3. But I've been interested in, yeah, Pedro Neto, who has played almost a half and half role. He's capable of playing in the front three. He's also capable of playing as an extra central midfielder. Nuno often talks about him dropping a line when they lose possession, i.e. dropping back from the forward line into the midfield line. I think it gives that kind of tactical flexibility that, in a way, Wolves haven't always had. They've been very well organised, but not necessarily that flexible within games. And I think it's quite interesting, because I thought of Neto as just a pure forward, really, before I saw this. And I don't think there's too many other players who you would think really would be comfortable doing that. I mean, maybe Jack Grealish would be the type who could do it. He's happy wide in a three. He's also more comfortable. I think his favoured position is as a number eight. So yeah, there's not too many players I think would be capable of doing that. And I don't think there's any other players who really are doing that on a regular basis.
Okay, let's talk about what was probably the game of the weekend in the Premier League. That was Spurs 2, Manchester City 0. Many people calling it a classic Mourinho masterclass. But Coxie, we're going to focus on some of the players involved. You were especially interested in the roles of Sissoko and Højbjerg in Mourinho's game plan.
Yeah, I thought what they did was really interesting. It was evident from the first minute, actually, with both Højbjerg and then later Sissoko, who were doing the same thing. They were basically dropping into the channel between Spurs fullback and centre-back on their side, obviously, and making a back five without the ball. And we've seen a bit of flexibility between a back four and a back five from various managers over the last couple of seasons, including Mourinho. But I'm not sure I've really seen a player doing it in that manner, you know, dropping between the fullback and the centre-back. So yeah, I mean, it was evident from the first minute, and I think it was pretty effective throughout the game.
Another thing with Højbjerg and Sissoko is that, and I don't think I've seen it at all otherwise this season in the Premier League, but in the ruled out goal for City and the build up to it, I think they doubled up on the I'm not sure who was on the ball for City, but the City attacker was on kind of the right-hand side of the box. They were like doubling up on him, and I don't think I've actually seen that for a while. I just found it interesting that they've both got, I mean, Højbjerg especially, he's just got so much energy to run around and cover spaces that he can even, you know, instead of marking the space outside the box or in it, he was, you know, capable of doubling up and then running back to kind of fulfill his space and stop any passes coming to the box. So I thought that was probably just a bit of a one-off, but I hadn't seen it happen for a while.
It's funny that you bring up Sissoko, particularly Michael, because I definitely had one of those rare moments watching that game. And it wasn't even that near the beginning of the game where I had to sort of check myself and say, is that Sissoko in that position? In which case, he's not playing the role I thought he was playing. And now you're explaining that he had something of a dual role. What was the purpose behind that, do you think?
Well, I think Mourinho was afraid that Spurs' back line would be overloaded 5-4. I mean, that's what City really like to do. They like to form a front five in possession. And of course, part of this is, you know, I think you've got to track the runs of De Bruyne. He's so good in that right-hand channel, and therefore Højbjerg was often dropping in to become almost a left-sided centre-back to stop him. But yeah, Sissoko was doing the same on the opposite side with Bernardo Silva's runs. I think the danger of that, obviously, is you end up weak in midfield if one of your central midfielders is not playing in midfield. But the quality they have there is they have Ndombele, who is playing as the number 10. He's maybe not a classic number 10 in the sense he's not really a kind of deep-lying forward. But the fact that he is comfortable as a central midfielder was perfect here, because he could drop in, he could sit alongside whichever the central midfielders wasn't dropping in. And then Spurs didn't really have that problem in midfield.
Yeah, Ndombele, for me, I'm glad you mentioned him, Michael, because he's just, I think he's one of the most fun players to watch in the Premier League at the moment. I mean, his press resistance, his ability to manipulate his body and wriggle away from, you know, from oncoming defenders is second to none, I feel, at this stage. And he really disguises some of his passes really nicely as well. He'll kind of he won't kind of show you with his body position where the pass is going to go. And I think that those passes where, you know, the player might be side on, but they manage to play a really nice vertical ball upfield, are some of the most, A, aesthetically pleasing, and B, kind of useful passes in the game. So yeah, he was, for me, you know, Soko and Højbjerg are so versatile and have so much utility, but Ndombele is just really, really good to watch.
Coxie, Pep Guardiola employing some funky fullback formatting is nothing new, and on the weekend and at the moment it's Cancelo really who's playing what is really in general terms quite an unusual role as well.
Yeah, I mean Guardiola's done this for the last few years, hasn't he, particularly at Bayern where he had Alaba and Lahm who he could use as kind of half a fullback and half a central midfielder. Yeah, and he's done it at Manchester City. I don't think always that's been his intention. You know, he brought in Benjamin Mendy because he wanted a proper overlapping left back at times. But I think the players who have most regularly played there have been probably Zinchenko and Delph, who are converted central midfielders. I mean, Cancelo's different because he's right-footed. So I think he's quite different from the ones who played it before. And I think the interesting thing is he's still been quite a good crosser this season. In fact, I think he's done really well at left back. I thought he was their best player in City's 1-1 draw at West Ham. He set up Phil Foden's equaliser. I thought he was really good against Liverpool too. He set up very good headed chance for Gabriel Jesus, who I thought just miscued it wide completely. But yeah, he's been very impressive on that side, and I don't think he probably expected to play there when he came to City. He's obviously more of a right back and is now playing as, yeah, half left back, half central midfielder.
The obvious question to the man who invented the phrase inverted winger is, are we calling this inverted fullback?
Yeah, so I'm not going for that. I'm going for half back. I wouldn't call them inverted because for me that's when you've got two fullbacks, one who's right footed and one who's left footed, and you switch them. I've never really seen that. But, you know, that's the equivalent of what wingers are. Robin and Ribery at Bayern, for example. Or indeed, Bolly and Kilman as centre-backs for Wolves. I think there's more of a case for calling them inverted than the fullbacks. But yeah, for me, it's not so much about what foot they use. It's just about the position. I mean, halfback comes from the old 2-3-5 pyramid system. So the players to the wide areas of the three-man midfield were halfbacks. That's more or less what these players do in those positions. And it also relates to, I mean, there's this German term that has found popularity in England, half spaces, which is roughly equivalent to the channels. And it's called that in Germany because that's where the half backs and the wing halves would play. So it's the space for the half players. So yeah, I think half back probably makes most sense.
Makes me think of when Zinedine Zidane won number 5 for Real Madrid and they said it's because he was half of the player he was wearing number 10 for France.
Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh. And despite literally spending months of my life playing Football Manager, I'm still terrible at it. That's why I'm launching the Football Manager Show, the latest podcast from The Athletic. Every week, I'll speak to the people who know the game best, the people who make the game. We'll take a proper look at things like training, recruitment, and tactics. We'll try to answer your questions. We'll do everything we can to keep you eager to play just one more game and altogether less inclined to quit without saving. The era of Cherno and Tonton and dear sweet Michael Duff is over. The new Football Manager is bigger, better, more challenging than ever. And I need some help. If you do too, you can subscribe now. Just look for the Football Manager Show by The Athletic, wherever you get all your other podcasts. It starts in November, and knowing my track record, I'll be unemployed by December.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
And Tom, the numbers, the data can be really handy here because a lot of people watch football with their aesthetics hat on and don't like to see fullbacks playing on their ostensibly weaker side, a right-footed player playing left-back, for example. But Cancelo, in chance creation terms, is looking pretty good in this role.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the data since the start of last season, he's really, really positive and strong in terms of just getting touches in the box, getting shots away, and even his the quality of his chances he's creating in terms of his expected assists is up there. It's the third highest in the league. It's higher than Andy Robertson and Lucas Digne, who are probably, you know, two of the players we think of more as out-and-out chance creators. Interestingly, I think this is because set pieces are included in the totes I'm looking at. Trent Alexander-Arnold is, of course, the kind of best chance creator from fullback. But second is Ahmed El Mohammadi for Aston Villa. small sample of just nearly 900 minutes, but still quite interesting. But yeah, I think that Cancelo definitely is one that is just an option that City haven't had really for a while, that of just like consistent chance creation. I think that Mendy was a really good option to start with, and obviously has had his troubles, and Zinchenko very much looks like a converted central midfielder playing fullback. Like, he just doesn't have the pace. I don't think he is as good in one-on-one situations to as Cancelo is.
Okay, and one that interests me specifically as a huge EFL nerd is James Justin of Leicester. He is also a right-footer playing at left-back, albeit someone that's been doing that for quite a while, having played that role for Luton as well. What do you make of him in that role for Leicester this season?
Yeah, Justin's one that I focused on a couple of weeks back, actually, for a piece on Leicester's fullbacks and a few other kind of tactical trends of Leicester's this season. And at the start of the season, Justin, when he was kind of in the left side of the back four, instead of now he's kind of the left side of this back three, was really keen on kind of being the spare man when there was a attack going forward. He'd always kind of time late runs into the box. He would be on the shoulder of the shoulder of the fullback, similar to, say, we saw with Theo Walcott's goal against Wolves on Monday night. So yeah, he was one who was doing really, you know, positive attacking work. But in the weeks that have passed, I think that we've started to see that it's kind of limited attacking potential, or at least it's not been unlocked to the same extent as it was at Luton. He's getting far fewer shots now. He's not creating chances. He's not really progressing the ball upfield as effectively as he was. So Justin is... it's an interesting one because I still feel he makes those runs, but he's just not getting the ball. He's not kind of being picked out, and therefore he's obviously not getting the numbers.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Leicester as well is for the first five games of the season, I think they fielded an 11 that didn't have a single left foot player. So yeah, it was often Justin who was on the left. But the other option there is Timothy Castagne, who obviously came in from Atalanta, has generally played right back and done very well. But he played roughly equally for Atalanta on the left and on the right. And obviously the player who has got to come back is Ricardo Pereira, who I think we're looking at the turn of the year for his return from injury. I think Ricardo Pereira is maybe, aside from Alexander-Arnold, probably the best fullback in the league. So I can't imagine that he won't be a regular. So it looks as if it will be Justin and Castagne who are competing for the left-back slot. Leicester now have slightly changed system. They've gone to back three. And because of that, Christian Fuchs has come into the side. Obviously, he is a natural left footer. But yeah, it was interesting to see them play 11 right footers and not really suffer in terms of a lack of balance.
There's another side that are using the nominal left back or left wing back role in different ways. It's Arsenal, Michael. Talk me through their situation at left wing back.
Yeah, so that's been very interesting from a couple of players. Both Bukayo Saka and Ainsley Maitland-Niles have both interpreted that position in an interesting way. They kind of start as a left wing back and then they push inside when Arsenal have possession to become a central midfielder. That's been interesting because I think it's harmed the pressing shape of the opposition. I think sometimes the right wing is dragged inside. That can open up space for Kieran Tierney to push forward almost on the overlap. I think Tierney's been absolutely exceptional as both a kind of third centre-back and also an overlapping wing-back at times. And it's also allowed Aubameyang to drop a little bit deep, drag the full-back up and then go in behind, which really was Arsenal's main strategy in the FA Cup final, where he kept on doing that to Reece James. And Arsenal kept on really launching big diagonal balls, usually from David Luiz, in behind. And that gave them the breakthrough, I think, with the penalty came from that. And of course, Aubameyang scored the second goal as well, proving he can play on the left despite a lot of people's objections to him in that position. And I think this kind of system, it can also force the opposition midfield across to shut down Saka or Maitland-Niles when they don't expect. You know, they think they're just going to be up against two central midfielders. Then they realise one of the central midfielders has to push across and cope with a third player in that zone. And that sometimes leaves space as everyone gets dragged over on the far side. I think Arsenal have played a lot of switches to Bellerin in space, which often has been their best outlet, really. And then Bellerin can charge forward in possession. So, yeah, it's been interesting. And I think at times, particularly the back end of last season in those two games at Wembley, really effective.
Tom, both of these players are, to some extent, in the category of what is your best position. And maybe after what we said at the top of the show, we shouldn't ask those sorts of questions, because the ability to interpret different roles and to perform in different roles is so important. But certainly with Maitland-Niles and Saka, although he's still so young, I wouldn't necessarily know or say with confidence this is their best position.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, I think you'd struggle definitely to pin down their best roles. I think that Maitland-Niles was really keen to actually leave in the summer, and I think that Wolves were a touted destination because he was so hell-bent on playing in central midfield. I remember he was actually, I think he started in the midfield that Arsenal deployed against Man United in the 8-2 game, I think. And I thought he was okay in that game. He was pretty good for it, given he was a couple of years younger than he is now. But Saka's he's just a really weird footballer where he is, I guess normally you'd have him down as a utility player if you're looking at kind of the way that positions were deemed of old. And he you know, attempts a lot of take-ons. He's pretty good at them. He gets in the box a lot. But also, I think the best thing about his game is just his intelligent runs. He came on against Leeds at the weekend, was essentially playing in that kind of very narrow front three, and had an excellent one-on-one chance that Ilham Meslier did so well to kind of scramble across and stop. So I do wonder with Maitland-Niles and Saka if they just need to stand up for themselves and say to Arteta, actually, I just want to play left back, or I just want to play central midfield, because they're getting dragged around the pitch like every single game. But yeah, I think that I do wonder what the implications are really for, in terms of player development for Saka. Will you learn a lot from playing in different positions, or will that fail to help you kind of specialise and nail down a position in the side longer term?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, to me, they almost seem slightly different categories of players, because I think Saka has the potential to be one of the best players in the league, and maybe you do want a more permanent position. But Maitland-Niles, with respect, I think if he was to leave Arsenal, he'd probably be going to a kind of mid-table side at best. And I think Arsenal over the years have sometimes not really appreciated the value of a versatile player. You know, someone like Oxlade-Chamberlain, for example, there are always questions about what's his best position. But sometimes I just think, I mean, compare Arsenal to kind of Manchester United in those years where they were kind of, you know, still rivals. And Manchester United always had players who, you know, were versatile, could do a different job each week. You know, someone like Park Ji-sung, what was his best position? I don't know, really. He could play, you know, equally well in probably three different roles, but it didn't really matter because he was so useful in big games. And what I like about Arteta is I think he appreciates the value of those players, and is capable of using players quite well tactically in a way that maybe Arsene Wenger didn't.
And just to continue on this theme of fullback funkiness, we're talking about Arsenal, we're talking about Arteta. Previously, we spoke about Cancelo and Pep Guardiola, who Arteta worked under for many years. Is this a different use of fullbacks from Pep's use of Cancelo, Coxie, or is this the same sort of thing?
I think it's a little bit different. I think Arteta's is more about possession play and disrupting the pressing of the opposition. I think Guardiola's primary use of players in that position is to prevent counterattacks. I mean, I think that's partly what he tried to do against Tottenham. Obviously, it didn't work because Son was used to that side and was very happy going down the outside and running in behind. I think Cancelo struggled with that. But it was quite interesting. In the game between Arsenal and Manchester City at the Etihad on match day 5, Cancelo was playing as a right back that day because Kyle Walker was right centre back to cope against Aubameyang's speed. And you had both Cancelo and Saka starting as a fullback or a wing back and moving inside into central midfield. And they were almost man marking each other the whole game, making the same movements. The game almost happened around them. So, yeah, I think they're playing a very similar role in terms of the positions, but maybe for a different reason.
But Saka and Maitland-Niles themselves, it's not like they're just being plugged in to do the same job, because they're different players, aren't they? They've got different skill sets. So talk me through the difference between those two individual players.
Yeah, I mean, I think Saka's much more creative. I think there's a couple of games this season, one at home to, was it West Ham maybe, where he created both goals with through balls. I think Maitland-Niles is a bit more functional. But that said, I mean, I really like Saka at left back too. When Arteta first came in, he was used as a kind of overlapping left back before Tierney was in the side. So that's where Arsenal got their left-footed balance from down that side. I think he's really, really good. I don't think it's inconceivable that, barring a couple of kind of injuries or whatever, he could play left back for England in the summer, because I really think he's that good in terms of getting him in the side and in terms of his defensive discipline as well.
I do feel that Saka's versatility will hopefully pay dividends down the line. It does seem that Arteta's favourite formation is going to be a 4-3-3, and he is kind of slowly building the pieces to try and move towards that. And I do feel that this 3-4-3 at the moment is just a bit of a stopgap. So if you're looking at, you know, Tierney is going to be the starting left back for Arsenal for probably many years at this point. Is Saka like dynamic enough to play in one of those kind of front three in the 4-3-3? I'm not entirely sure, but as a, you know, being able to be one of these free eights and sit alongside Thomas Partey, again, this is where his difference to Maitland-Niles in terms of he's more dynamic. He's a good passer. Like I said before, he makes really smart runs. I think those kind of attributes will serve him well if that's eventually where Arteta wants his side to be at.
Still only 19, of course, Saka. Plenty of development of his game and positionally as well to come. Okay, just a couple of other examples before we wrap up. Michael, you're taking us away from the Premier League for this one, a game that you watched and enjoyed on the weekend.
Yeah, so on the subject of kind of unusual wingbacks, I really enjoyed Atletico Madrid's performance at the weekend against Barcelona in a 1-0 win. From the team sheet, I assume this was a kind of classic Simeone 4-4-2, but Yannick Carrasco was the key player here because he dropped back to mark Ousmane Dembele, who was playing on the right for Barcelona. I guess it was a little bit like Mourinho's tactics to form a five-man defence almost in a certain phase of the game. And that turned Atletico from a 4-4-2 into a 5-3-2 with Carrasco as the left wing-back. But the interesting thing was that, as well as doing a decent job, not a perfect job against Dembele, because he did get in a couple of times, but a decent job by and large, he then really led the counter-attacks. You know, coming from deep, and the fact that Dembele wasn't seeking to track back with him meant that he was often the one who dribbled forward. He was making storming runs almost in behind the defence. I think he got caught offside a couple of times. And that's what led to the opener. He basically, yeah, just sprinted forward when Atletico won the ball. No one really tracked his run. And he ended up being played in for one-on-one with Ter Stegen. And Ter Stegen misjudged it quite badly and got bypassed about 45 yards from his goal. And Carrasco curled the ball in from about 30 yards. So yeah, it was one of those games that was great for me. I watched it 30 minutes in, thought Carrasco's really interesting here. I'm going to have to write about him. And then he goes and scores the winner. Perfect.
Yeah, that's the dream, I guess, for a tactics writer. Tom, it struck me listening to Michael talk about Carrasco that in many of these cases, we're looking at a player, you know, not any player can just morph into different roles within the same game. And not any player can have this universality of being able to play in a number of very different roles on the pitch. And one of the sort of key similarities, I guess, is intelligence, footballing intelligence. That's kind of obvious, I think, being able to carry out instructions very, very closely. But also, certainly in Carrasco's case, insane athleticism and stamina as well, to be able to physically move yourself from position to position, you know, after a transition of possession. And I suppose Sissoko would fall into that category as well, having done it on the weekend. And I guess I say all that to lead into the last man that we're going to talk about, Stuart Dallas of Leeds United, who I've watched over the last two or three seasons play almost every single position on the pitch. And he's never been considered, even at championship level, one of the most impressive players technically. But for Bielsa and for what Bielsa wants his teams to do, Stuart Dallas is the absolute superstar in many ways.
Yeah, definitely. Dallas is, I guess, epitomises this halfback idea. And for me, I think that his most similar player that comes to mind to him is maybe Joshua Kimmich at Bayern Munich. Just the way that he, you know, started at wide as a fullback and then came inside and kind of this double pivot. But Dallas kind of regularly from left back would cut in field as part of the Bielsa system and kind of move and help progress play through there. And then is actually, you know, able to start in midfield just because he knows that role so well from cutting it from fullback. And I think it's the same maybe to a lesser extent than the other side with Alioski. He again is so used to kind of cutting inside from left back into midfield. And yeah, if we're coming a bit full circle here on you know, talk about Coxie's piece to start with about Bielsa, but maybe one role that we haven't mentioned at all and we should is just the fact that Bielsa so often will play a second striker kind of in midfield, like with Rodrigo or with Tyler Roberts, which to me is again one of the more kind of weird positions that has been so common at the Championship the last few years under Bielsa. And we've not really seen that so much in the Premier League, especially having a 4-1-4-1 that's so well defined as Leeds is.
It's a classic structure. Mention something at the very start and come back to it at the very end. They don't let me anywhere near the site in written terms, so I'm having to sort of try out all of these things on the pod. Thank you both, guys, for talking me through this today. Really, really interesting stuff. And I think just a great example of why we wanted to do this podcast. So thank you both for your time and your expertise as well. And you guys listening, I've no doubt that during this, you'll have been thinking of other examples. There are plenty of them, of course, and it'd be great to hear from you. You can tweet any or all of us, if you like, with any interesting things you've seen. We're always keen to hear about that and look into it more, and who knows, could be a potential topic for the pod in future. So thank you for listening. Please make sure you're subscribed to this. We're doing different things every week and really enjoying ourselves at the moment. So please do be a part of it. Of course, you can listen for free on any podcast platform, but you can also listen ad-free if you're a subscriber of The Athletic site. TheAthletic.com/zonal marking is a code that you can use to sign up. And all I'm going to say here is, it's Black Friday this week, the week that we're recording. We're recording on Wednesday morning. If you hold tight towards the end of the week, take a look for a Black Friday offer for a very, very good price for your annual subscription, and do make the most of that. Thank you for listening. Go and read Tom and Michael's work on The Athletic site and app, and join us again next week on the Zonal Marking podcast, brought to you by The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.